50 years ago in Marshfield on April 10th, 1970, the American Tea Company had a number one hit record titled I Want You Now. I had the opportunity to speak with band members Mark T. Nelson, Jim Hsu, and Ken Rogers, and they discussed their time in the band and more.
You're from the Marshfield area, and back in, this was 1967. Can you talk about how you guys got together and what made you decide, hey, let's start a band?
Sure. Well, like all young boys interested in music, we've probably been playing in little bands since junior high school, and I know Ken and Jim were in one. I was in a different one. And Jim or Ken, you want to pick it up from where we first got together as the Tea Company?
I think Ken and I started playing together in seventh grade, if I'm not mistaken, and we had a couple of different bands. Mostly the same people, but not completely. We had a little bit of a change with our first two groups, but Ken lived in the same neighborhood where Mark and Gary grew up, and so they knew each other from being neighborhood friends, and I think Ken and I were looking for something a little more, going off to high school, something a little more upscale, and Gary and Mark both seemed interested, and Ken, you take it from there.
We've been playing just some kind of like house parties type things, Jim and I, and we were interested in doing more, and we typically learned all the top songs at the time. We did find another bass player that was quite flamboyant. And another singer that was quite flamboyant.
Yes.
It didn't work out, so we kind of changed personality.
So the flamboyant ones flamed out, you might say.
Yes.
There you go, exactly.
Very nice, very nice.
They were like, like a Mick Jagger, but couldn't sing.
Right, right. All the pretension and none of the talent.
Right, right.
Yes.
Very good.
We found a group that matched, and then we found another bass player from our high school, and it seemed to really click right away. Not only click, but it was fun to play with each other, play the music, and we seemed to agree on the type of music we wanted to play, and we rehearsed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, the high school, we were rehearsing at least a couple times a week. There was one stretch of time. I think it was a whole summer, probably the summer of 68. Correct me if I'm wrong.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
We played or practiced every day.
Wow.
Or rehearsed every day. So if we weren't performing, we were rehearsing.
Yeah. And I will say, Gary and I were in the high school madrigal group, the Marshfield High School Madrigal Group, which, you know, gets a lot of promotion around town now. And so we both were pretty reasonably good singers, you know, sort of that general group of singers who were competent. And so we had that concept of vocal harmony and doing that. And I actually remember, I think Jim, Ken, and Gary had sort of gotten together a little bit earlier, and I was singing at a madrigal, Christmas time thing at one of the churches on some evening service or something. And afterwards, we were in the changing room, getting out of our tights and, you know, into our blue jeans. And Gary said, "Hey, I'm playing with these guys in a band, and you play keyboard. Why don't you come on over sometime?" And so that's how it happened. And we rehearsed in Ken's basement. That was the first time I sort of auditioned for you, and I got the gig.
Cool, very cool. So then, where did the name the American Tea Company come from?
Actually, I think it was a friend of mine who suggested it, but I believe at the time the Paul Revere and the Raiders were very big.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if you think of the American Tea Company, kind of like the Boston Tea Party,
mm-hmm.
you know, we were wearing the same kind of Paul Revere and the Outfit Raiders for one of our sets anyway. And at least I think that's kind of where it came from.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I was going to say, at that time, there were all sorts of band names that were like that. The 1910 Fruit Gum Company, the Chicago Transit Authority, which later shortened it to Chicago, and that's how they became most famous. But they were Chicago Transit Authority. So you had this type of name seemed right. And, of course, the word tea, besides the, sort of the patriotic implication of tea, the Boston Tea Party, is also sort of an implication of illicit weed or something. I always thought, you know, not that we touched the stuff.
I remember A&P Foods, American and Pacific.
Right.
I think their original title was American and Pacific Tea Company.
Atlantic and Pacific.
Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. So we got a variation of that. I think the ideas came from multiple fronts.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Cool.
And the double entendre was appreciated.
Right. Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, very cool. And so things kind of started to take off for you guys when you did a Battle of the Bands up in Medford, I believe it was. Can you talk about that?
Well, I know that we were the second band to perform, I believe, at Medford, and I think they had about seven or eight bands. And when we were done, we had another gig. We were packing up to go play somewhere else, and the judges came up and said, "You have to come back." So we did our gig, and we went back, and we won, and we did an encore. So we played three gigs that day.
Very nice, very nice. All right, cool. And then so, I mean, at what point then did you guys decide to, you know, did you stop and say, hey, you know, maybe we could make an album with our music?
Well, I think continuing with that Battle of the Bands thing, winning in Medford allowed us to go to Eau Claire to be in the semifinals, and we took second place there, and that would have allowed us to go on to state.
Oh.
But they felt we were too professional, even though we were all still in high school. We were too professional to be in the competition. But I believe the prize was a recording studio opportunity, mm-hmm. if you won the Milwaukee deal. So I think we had that seed planted in our heads that it would be fun to make a record. And so I think we just did it on our own.
Okay. And, I mean, that must have been kind of a nice compliment, though, to say, hey, you know, you guys are too professional, you're too good, we can't have you go into this competition.
At the time, it didn't seem that way. At the time, we thought it was very unfair.
Yeah, yeah.
Part of the excuse, or part of the reasons for disqualifying us, was that we were playing so often for money. We were getting compensation for these gigs. And then I think somebody leaked that us three were in the musicians' union, because some of the gigs we played required that you must be in the union, must be a union band.
Mm.
So I guess that criteria made some sense to the judges.
I see.
That,
okay.
These guys are pros, they're union members, they're getting paid.
It makes sense.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, cool.
All the time, but it made sense.
You're right. Yeah. Well, cool. Very cool. So then, can you talk a little bit about what it was like to put that album together? How was that experience for you guys?
Well, it wasn't really an album. It was a 45.
Right. Okay.
It was amazing. The studio was fantastic. It was a relatively new studio built by some engineers that left Nashville.
Oh. Okay.
It's in Central Illinois, Bloomington area. They had already produced albums and singles by a number of groups, including the band that did I'm Your Vehicle, maybe...
Ides of March,
a couple other bands. The studio was the state-of-the-art, and this was arranged by our agent, set us up, and they set us up with a producer. We didn't know what a producer was. We didn't know what a producer did. He was fantastic. A couple hundred dollars extra to have this producer in for the day. It was just great that he listened to our songs. And we had a bunch of originals. He said, this one and this one. And I remember Mark and Gary having to go off and finish up the lyrics for one of those songs. I can't remember which one.
I think it was Don't Leave Your Love.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, the thing was, we were skilled at playing in live venues. We knew how to adjust our sounds and make it work. But you go in a recording studio, and this is just something we weren't aware of. And this fellow, the producer, just was great as kind of a guide to that process. He tightened certain things up, made us recognize that not all instruments could be playing full volume simultaneously for the whole record. You know, you have to have some balance there and let the lyrics come through. And for their part, I think they liked working with us. Jim, what was it that they said about Gary's ability to multi-track?
That he had the ability to sing almost exactly the same on every take.
Yeah.
The voice control.
Right. What they did, there was an uncommon recording track, at recording idea at the time, actually developed by Les Paul, that they would sing one side of the stereo, mm-hmm. and then they would sing the same thing on the other side of the stereo to give that live feel. Ooh. And what Gary did is he was able to replicate it so it sounded not quite live, but giving that extra stereo feel. And they were just amazed at that he was able to match himself so well stereo to side to side on the stereo.
Wow, that's cool.
It was an uncommon technique. Not many people knew about it.
Right, yeah. Well, very cool. Cool. And then, you know, once you got that 45 recorded and then your song started climbing up on the charts, I mean, that must have been quite an experience to see, to know that the song that you had was making its way up the charts and got quite high, actually.
Yeah, well, Jim has all the numbers on that and the way we climbed up WDLB's charts. But I have to say that once we had the record, then when we'd go out and play gigs, we'd talk about it, we'd sell copies, we'd go to local radio stations and sometimes have interviews like this, except it wasn't on Zoom, it was across the desk. and so that was exciting. And of course, our message to the kids who are our big fans is call the radio station, request the number.
Very cool. Very cool. And yeah, it's fitting that, you know, it did so well, you know, as it did in Marshfield, you know, where you guys are from, right here on WDLB. So that's very awesome.
Sure.
Yeah, it did get some play and a little bit of play in Milwaukee and Chicago stations. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that happened, but we got copies out to them, and we had gotten secondhand information that they had heard it through those stations.
All right. And then can you talk a little bit then about, you know, after the song made its way up the charts, what were kind of some of the final performances then for the group?
Well, I'm looking actually at our calendar from 1970.
Okay.
And at the time that our records hit the charts, we were playing at a state convention, the WBEC State Convention in Green Lake, Wisconsin. Earlier that week, we played at Columbus High School on April 1st. Then we played on April 4th at the Barn in Sterling, Illinois. Then we were at the Port Edwards High School the next Friday, April 10th. Then we were in Abbotsford the 17th and 18th, in Wausau on the 24th at the Cotillion, in Minneapolis on the 26th, playing the Minneapolis Convention Hall, and that must have been the national convention for
the DECA organization, DECA. High school kids. But it was a national convention, and it was the only gig, I think, that where we actually drove with our station wagon and trailer right onto the floor of the convention center. They had a stage set up there, and we drive in, unload, and then have to drive out to the parking area there afterwards. And that was just an amazing thing to play this whole convention center full of kids who were
dancing. It was huge.
So you guys had a full schedule then when it came to your live performances.
We were playing pretty much twice a week most of the time, it looks like. Maybe once a week here and there. But yeah, very busy. And then in the summer, three, four times a week.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
I, I never wanted to take gigs on school nights because I did want to be able to graduate from high school and go to college, you know, and the other guys as well. Nonetheless, in 1969, your 1969 book a few years ago, Jim, you tallied up and that we had played 150 gigs that year.
Oh, wow.
Not taking school night gigs. You know, I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Right.
But, you know, 1969, I think we had a six-night stand at Wisconsin Dells at the Purple Haze, for instance. So, you know, the numbers add up. And it's a good way to polish your music. You know, you really get so you're just feeling the other guys and staying in sync. And I think that showed in our level of professionalism and what the crowd was hearing.
All right, good, very good.
A side story about the Dells. Mm-hmm. We've told this a couple times, but we played it at a 6-night stand, and we got done with the gig, and the owner said, "Well, you guys didn't repeat a song all week long."
Wow, that's very cool.
Which is probably not true at all. He didn't think we repeated a song.
Yeah.
Exactly. But that was an example of how we had 6 nights, and so we sort of strategized before, are we going to play the same repertoire every night after night? And we said, well, the kids wouldn't want to come back for that night after night. So we figured out how to mix it up, how to extend some of our songs that were extendable, like the Doors song or the 20-minute drum solo songs that kids liked at the time, you know. And so we found a way to make it a different experience every night musically.
Yeah, well, good, very good. And then, you know, now that this was obviously 50 years ago that happened, but do you find yourselves, like, do you guys get recognized, or do you still have people reach out and say, hey, I saw you back in the Dells, you know, back in this year, or I remember when you played at the high school back in this year? I mean, does that still happen to you guys?
Yes, it does.
Yeah?
Yes, it does.
It does.
I was at the hands-off protest in Marshfield on April 4th this year, and three different people came up, and I was playing the piano to play some songs for people that day, and three people came up to me afternoon, good job on the piano, and I said, you've been playing long? I said, yeah, I used to play in a group called American Tea Company. Oh, I love those guys. I remember when you played at XYZ, you know? So people do remember.
Right. Well, good. That's very cool.
I remember, Mark, you had wanted to mention about Neillsville, that we played at the Silver Dome a few times, and I know that they had a local battle of the bands, and they had us be their judges.
Oh.
And that was quite an honor, if I remember correctly.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Silver Dome.
I was playing a jazz fest 2 weeks ago, and a guy comes up to me. Same thing. But he had seen one of the articles that came out in the newspaper that, yes, you remember the American Tea Company. It's very effusive about remembering it. And I'm playing with another group this afternoon, and the bass player used to hear us at Thorpe.
Oh, yep.
And on Frog Hop.
Milo Way
at Frog Hop. Yes, Milo Way
at Thorpe. Yeah, Frog Hop at Cadott, and oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So many area places. In Marshfield, you know, the Roselleville Ballroom. Marshfield had a youth center at that time, and so we played at the youth center. We played at each of the high schools in town. We played at Stratford, Roselleville Ballroom, you know, up in that area. A lot of bars and school dances in that whole vicinity.
I remember the Colby Sportsman's Park. And it was a big wooden round barn, and they allowed the kids there to paint the logos of the bands inside the building, and ours was huge. It's amazing.
Yeah, but Riley, those were different times. There were so many venues for live music, and it was affordable. Kids could go out and have fun doing that. There was, you know, they're not sitting and listening to their, you know, their streaming services and stuff like that, and living in their own world. They go out and dance and enjoy it. And so we made a lot of friends. We had fans who would follow us around. For instance, when we played at Waupaca, we had people coming from Stevens Point, down from Wausau, and over from Appleton. When we played at Appleton, people would come from Manitowoc. And, you know, I mean, it was just how it worked, because kids wanted something to do, and but they wanted to listen to good music, and I guess we did well enough that they called us that.
Yeah, you fit that bill, yeah.
I remember playing at the Mile Away in Thorpe, and we were doing a lot of Doors. People kept requesting Doors, and at the end of the set, some people came up and said, "We just saw Jim Morrison and the Doors in Minneapolis. You guys sound better than them." I couldn't believe it.
Having read Jim Morrison's biographies, I suspect that we were not drunk and he was on that weekend.
Right, yeah. Well, that's cool. That's very cool. And now, this kind of leads me into my next question. Like, are you guys, musically, you're still involved in some stuff. Can you kind of touch on that?
Mark, go first. Why don't you go ahead?
Okay, well, I sing in Central Chamber Chorale. I've directed choirs and so on, but my rock and roll is the Pointless Brothers right here in Marshfield.
Okay.
Jim, why don't you?
Well, since the American Tea Company, I've probably been in more than a dozen bands. Ken and I have been in a few of them together. Currently, I'm playing with a guy named Mark Healy, and Mark is actually, he's been in the band Badfinger since 1986. And unfortunately, Joey Mollen, the last original member, just passed away about 2 months ago. And so Badfinger is no longer in existence. But I feel pretty lucky to be playing with all of the different musicians I've played with through the years. In the last few years, I've had the opportunity to play with probably four or five different bands, to actually go out and do a whole gig, either with duos or with bands. And it's so much fun to still be able to do it.
I still played music, and I was a music teacher for many years before going into school administration. I've played jazz. I still play jazz. I still play folk music. I just did a big thing on St. Pat's Day with an Irish group. I play folk instruments. I collect instruments. I have a collection of probably 100 instruments. I play popular music yet with a duo, and I sit in. Play all kinds of music, sometimes at church. So I just got a request this morning. I'm supposed to do do the masses in March. Yeah. In May. So yeah, I still play, still keep involved. Try to keep up writing music, still write music.
Go to Arizona, and you play down in Arizona as well.
I played with a jazz group in Arizona. I played with that Irish group down there. I played music in, I went over to Europe and studied with a folk group over there in Bavaria. I did some graduate studies, postdoctorate studies at U of A on flamenco guitar.
Keeping up. Yeah, very cool. It's really neat that after all these years, you know, your guys' passion for the music has continued, and you continue on with the different projects, and you know, it all kind of started with your hit back in the, you know, the little town of Marshfield.
Well, I think music keeps people young. I know I play at the Veterans Home here, and they say that, you can see, people are singing along. They know the words. They might not know their children's names, but they remember the words to the music, and it does keep people young. I think being able to get out, I mean, it's good exercise. It gets your heart going. I think it's a really good thing for everybody.
Absolutely, and I guess Ken, of course, was a school musician as well, and I think supporting music in the schools, or just having music in people's lives, as Jim said, is so important, and I hope that we can keep the funding necessary for that. And also, I used In my checkered career, I was a college admission counselor at one point. And, you know, the advice I have for kids and their parents is don't try to figure out what job you're going to have for the rest of your life. Try to figure out what you want to know and what you want to be as a person. And music can be an important part of that. It doesn't have to be your job, although it was our jobs at one point, and I was a professional musician in the Twin Cities. I played the USO tour and wound up, we played at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, for instance, and I was a music director for that group. So it's a great thing to have in your life, to keep music there, and what you use to pay your bills can be something different, but what you feed your soul with can come from elsewhere.
And there's another point I think that Ken made really well the other day, and that is what we learned from being in the band helped us with our lives, our business lives, how to be a good person, how to get ahead, how to use what you've got. And it was great experience as high school kids to be running a business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Work hard, you study intelligently. You know, work with people, interact with people. Those are some formulas for success in almost any business and any career.
All right, excellent. And, you know, now since you guys disbanded, you have done a few reunion shows, so to speak, here and there. Have you had a chance at any point recently here to get back together and play like the good old days?
We've talked about it. It hasn't happened.
Right. Yeah, I understand. Busy schedules.
Absolutely.
All right.
You know, Ken was talking about the business aspect, and Ken, you reminded me the other day of we had this, when we were promoting the record or promoting the band, we actually created a Christmas card, one of these things that the photo services would print, and it said, "Peace on Earth," and there we were in our band-type costumes, giving the peace symbol, peace on earth, and we mailed that out to our mailing list of clubs that we played at, so that we were promoting ourselves, but also, well, keeping in mind the need to that we were running a business, I guess. I didn't say that very well, but anyway, that was, sorry.
Marketing.
Right. Marketing 101.
Right. Well, and back in the day, that was how you had to do it. I mean, nowadays, kids can just jump onto TikTok or Instagram and make themselves famous, but, you know, back then, you had to make cards and write out letters and send that kind of stuff out.
You had to go to Central Illinois to record.
Right. Right, exactly. Now anyone can just do it right on their phone.
Yes,
that's true.
Maybe not as good as what we did.
Right, exactly. All right, excellent. Well, we've touched on quite a bit here within our interview, but is there anything else you would like our listeners to know about that we may not have already discussed?
Well, I remember how supportive WDLB was at the time. The DJs were so helpful and welcoming. And, you know, if we would stop into the studio during that time we were on the radio, it was, you know, everybody was happy to see us. It was a really fun time.
Absolutely. And to this day, I live in Marshfield, you guys, and WDLB still has that local presence that makes that happen, which we really appreciate for a lot of the things that we do in town.
You can hear their hit, I Want You Now, on YouTube, as well as on 1450 AM and 98.7 FM WDLB.